From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
The bridge today is also being renamed by President Mandela as the Biko Bridge, which is a terrific irony because for 25 years it has been known as the Forster Bridge after the apartheid Prime Minister B.J. Forster, and now today it's going to be renamed the Biko Bridge.
South Africa honors one of its fallen heroes. Today is the 20th anniversary of the death of Black consciousness leader Stephen Biko. The U.S. military is set to spend $43 billion on some fighter planes and an update on the landmine ban negotiations in Oslo. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The U.S. and Israel clashed over the issue of settlement construction. U.S. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, who winds up her visit to Israel today, urged its leaders in a televised speech to suspend unilateral actions directed at Palestinians, such as settlement expansions, land seizures, and demolition of Palestinian homes. A Netanyahu aide said there would be no freeze. Albright earlier met with PLO chair Yasser Arafat and pressed him for a crackdown on militants following recent bombings. The cycle of bombings followed by closings of Israel's borders has cut the incomes of Palestinians by one-third since the 1993 Oslo Accord was signed. Roger Tamrez met regularly with CIA operatives for 25 years to provide them with information. This according to the deposition the Lebanese-American businessman gave to Senate campaign investigators. At yesterday's hearings, President Clinton National Security aide Sandy Berger said his staff often wasn't asked to screen questionable visitors such as Tamrez. Meanwhile, Asian American groups have asked for a federal civil rights investigation, saying they're being made scapegoats in the campaign fundraising affair. Separately, the administration says it's looking into allegations that some Asian Americans were briefly stopped at White House gates by suspicious guards. The Teamsters' Ron Carey faces a federal review on whether he should be barred from running for union president. The federal election official who threw out the vote he won last year says she's received unspecified new information that could affect the decision for the upcoming election. The Army has issued a surprising indictment of itself, asserting that sexual harassment exists throughout the Army, crossing gender, rank, and racial lines. Sexual discrimination was found to be even more prevalent, and the service's rank and file uniformly do not have trust and confidence in their leaders on the issues, according to the study. The Army accused commanders of ignoring the problems and allowing inappropriate behavior to be commonplace, contending leaders were more focused on combat deployments and cutbacks than taking care of the needs of their most vulnerable soldiers. The service's largest ever study of sexual harassment was ordered in the aftermath of the scandal last November at the U.S. Army Ordnance Center in Aberdeen, Maryland, where drill sergeants preyed on young female recruits. Army Secretary Togo West attempted to draw a distinction between sexual harassment, which he said continues to be a problem throughout the service, and the sexual abuses, rape, and assaults at Aberdeen. Excitement has mounted among the Indians of rural Mexico as a historic march by Zapatista rebels vowing to defend their rights neared its destination in Mexico City. Women and children lined the roadside with flowers as 100 buses carrying guerrillas of the Zapatista National Liberation Army, known as the EZLN, and their supporters passed through impoverished Oaxaca into Puebla State on their way to the capital. Some 1,500 peasants, many of them Mixtec Indians from across the region, converged on this tiny hamlet in Mexico to welcome the rebel caravan with marching bands and showers of confetti. House conservatives left their stamp on one of the biggest federal spending bills, winning a ban on funding for needle exchange programs and extending anti-abortion language to include managed care plans. The House left for next week another highly contentious issue, President Clinton's plan for national reading and math tests. An alliance of Republican conservatives and Democratic liberals are poised to kill that. The House has been bogged down for more than a week in debate on an $80 billion bill to pay for labor, health, and education programs in fiscal year 1998. Conservatives protested some of the big spending programs contained in the balanced budget agreement reached between Republican leaders and Clinton. The smallest of the three unions striking San Francisco's rapid transit system has reached an agreement. Members of the American Federation of State and Municipal Employees, known as AFSCME, voted in favor of a tentative three-year contract yesterday. That union represents 225 mid-level Bay Area rapid transit managers. But the other two larger unions continue their talks. Construction has begun on a new monument that sheds some light on history's forgotten troops, African Americans who served in the Civil War. The African American Civil War Memorial Foundation estimates at least 7 million blacks are descended from Civil War servicemen. The foundation broke ground yesterday on the $2 million 9-foot-high bronze sculpture in Washington. It's scheduled to be dedicated next spring. Two stone walls around the statue will bear the names of an estimated 209,000 soldiers who served in the United States' so-called colored troops. And North Carolina has been ordered to issue license plates with the Confederate flag on it. And that's some of the news at this hour. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. With the end of the Cold War and the collapse of the former Soviet Union, most analysts agree there remains no serious military threat to the United States and the world. But the military budget still dominates federal spending, and war and peace questions are still crucial to millions around the planet. For the last 2 weeks, delegates from more than 100 countries have been gathered in Oslo, Norway, to hammer out a treaty outlawing anti-personnel landmines. The mines kill or maim an estimated 26,000 people every year. But the big powers, China, Russia, and the United States, have balked at international restrictions on landmines. At the same time, Congress is now in the midst of examining the Pentagon's budget and some specific weapons programs, including the most expensive plane in the world, the B-2 bomber. The House has already voted hundreds of millions of dollars for a down payment on 9 additional B-2s, which the Congressional Budget Office estimates will cost $27 billion to build and maintain. Already, the U.S. has paid for 21 B-2s. Well, joining us to talk about these matters is Gordon Clark. He's the executive director of Peace Action, which is the nation's largest grassroots peace and disarmament organization, and it's celebrating its 40th anniversary this year. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Gordon.
Good morning, Amy.
Well, let's see. Where should we start? Let's start with the Oslo talks. About a week ago, we went to Oslo and spoke with some of the people there who are leading the campaign for a total ban on landmines. And of course, this has gotten a lot of attention in the last few weeks, even though the movement has been going on for a long time because of the death of Princess Diana, who also supported this total ban. What is happening now in the second week of the negotiations?
Well, at this point, the major story, Amy, is still the attempts by the United States delegation to get certain types of anti-personnel landmines banned or excluded from the ban, I should say. And those are specifically smart anti-personnel mines. I put smart in quotation marks, which they're trying to call submunitions. And basically, those are anti-personnel landmines, which are mixed in with anti-tank landmines in single munition canisters, and they cover three different types of mines that the United States currently owns. So there's no evidence that the United States is being at all successful in trying to get this exception, but that's what they're pushing for very hard right now. And my fear is that they're really embarrassing themselves. We are embarrassing ourselves in the eyes of the world by trying to do this.
Well, it's interesting. We just got this report on Reuters that the United States is saying today that it cannot sign the global treaty banning anti-personnel landmines in the form produced by this multinational conference in Oslo, although it says it's committed to signing on the right terms. The U.S. Has failed to win support for its calls to exempt three anti-tank weapons with anti-personnel devices and to exempt Korea from the accord. And that is what they're saying, at least at this point.
And that news bulletin was just rushed in even as we talk. Well, that's not surprising, and I think what this points to is the continued need for United States citizens to be calling the White House and really pressuring President Clinton to go to Ottawa and to accept this ban with no loopholes and no exceptions. It's important to realize that the only reason that the Clinton administration is involved in these negotiations to begin with is because of all the pressure that the American public has put on. You'll recall that originally President Clinton was not going to involve the U.S. in the Ottawa process, but we wanted to go through the Conference on Disarmament in the United Nations, which is a notoriously slow and laborious process. So it was public public pressure that brought him to the Ottawa process to begin with, and I think it's going to be public pressure that will get the U.S. to accept a ban, a total ban with no exceptions and no loopholes.
Well, let's go through it again. I was watching Nightline last night where one of, well, the head of the negotiating team, I guess, in Oslo, was talking about why Korea was so critical, saying it would mean that tens of thousands of U.S. troops would have to be added to the, you know, the area of the demilitarized zone if you didn't have those landmines.
Well, we have a different answer. We think South Korea should be able to protect itself at this point, actually. You know, landmines are an antiquated weapon. They also had on Nightline last night Bobby Mueller, who's a former Vietnam vet. He's leading the campaign in the U.S. And what he said was that in Vietnam, thousands of U.S. casualties came from landmines, and that landmines are, in fact, more dangerous to U.S. troops or as dangerous to U.S. troops as they are to the enemy. So there's really no need for the landmines to be there in the first place. And in the second place, there's no need, frankly, for U.S. troops to be there. You know, you have South Korea, which has something like 10 times the gross national product of North Korea. South Korea has four times the military budget of North Korea. We all know North Korea is a basket case economically. South Korea should be able to defend itself. So the argument that we have to keep landmines in Korea to protect troops that shouldn't be there in the first place, I think, is a weak argument at best.
Mueller's organization, Vietnam Veterans of America Foundation, came out with this interesting report talking about the number of U.S. multinational, U.S. corporations that make landmines. I think it's like around 47. Mm-hmm. Have they entered into this debate?
I'm sure they're entered into the debate in terms of talking to the White House and possibly some members of Congress. One of the interesting things about this, though, is the strong support, bipartisan support, that the total ban is getting in Congress. And right now, Senator Leahy of Vermont, who is a senator who went over to Oslo to encourage the negotiators over there, he has introduced a bill in support of this total ban, which now has 60 sponsors on it, which is a rather phenomenal number when you consider the current makeup of our Senate. So my guess is that the industry is probably not talking to that many senators right now since there's such strong support for the ban. I'm sure they're talking to the White House.
So you're part of a coalition of groups that is leading this campaign to make calls to the White House?
Yeah, we're part, Peace Action is part of the U.S. campaign to ban landmines, which is a coalition made up of 235 organizations in the United States, peace groups, human rights groups, humanitarian aid groups, that are working to stop what is essentially a global humanitarian crisis where thousands of people are killed every single year by landmines. The number people should call, and I really do again encourage folks to call, and will repeat that it's citizen pressure that brought President Clinton into the Ottawa negotiating process to begin with. It's going to be citizen pressure that makes them drop, that makes the U.S. drop these absurd conditions for loopholes and exceptions. We really encourage everyone to call the White House, and the number there for comments is 202-456-1111. Number again is 202-456-1111. And simply ask President Clinton to sign the Ottawa Treaty to ban landmines. No loopholes, no exceptions. It's a very clear message. We think even the White House can understand it.
We're talking to Gordon Clark, who is the head of Peace Action. Peace Action is the largest grassroots peace and disarmament group in this country. Earlier in the news, I read that the House has been bogged down for more than a week in debate on an $80 billion bill to pay for labor, health, and education programs, and talking about conservatives protesting some of the big spending programs in the balanced budget agreement. Well, let's talk about some big spending.
Big spending.
Moving from landmines to B-2 bombers and F-22 stealth fighter planes. F-22 fighter planes. Can you talk about, first of all, the B-2?
Oh, can we talk about the B-2? This has got to be one of the classic biggest boondoggles, military or otherwise, ever in the federal budget. The B-2, as I'm sure most of your listening audience knows, is the world's most expensive airplane. They currently cost $2 billion apiece. And the latest report from the General Accounting Office revealed that the skin of the plane, which is the key to its stealth ability, quote-unquote stealth ability to evade radar, that the skin is, in fact, damaged by rain, heat, and excessive humidity. which means, among other things, that it can't be deployed overseas because it needs special climate-controlled shelters even to sit in a runway, and that every time it goes out, it needs extensive repairs when it returns because almost any climatic condition other than perfect weather will damage the skin, which is supposed to protect this incredibly expensive bomber.
Now, Gordon, that's not what Northrop Grumman has to say in today's Washington Post.
I'm sorry, Amy.
Two-thirds page ad, which shows that they're under pressure here. It says, B-2 myths and realities setting the record straight. The myth is the B-2 can't fly its missions in the rain because its stealth coatings will come off. Reality, rain is not a deterrent to a B-2 mission once the plane has been properly prepared and launched. On a real combat mission, B-2 crews would actually prefer rain because it would hurt the performance of an air defense system. Can you explain that part? I guess it's interesting. I think the operative phrase here is rain is not a deterrent to the B-2 mission once the plane has been properly prepared and launched.
Well, I think your emphasis really shows that Northrop Grumman is making a last-ditch attempt at spin control here. And it's interesting that in their very expensive full-page ad, which is tax-deductible, by the way, for the corporation, they don't even directly address the General Accounting Office report. They don't try to refute what it says there. They simply try and spin their way out of it.
What do you mean it's tax deductible?
That's one of the things that corporations can deduct taxes for, is this type of advertising.
Really? Actually, it was in Tuesday's Washington Post.
The other comment, there's another comment there where they say that actually its mission operable rate, the ability to perform its mission, how often it can do that, is actually quite high for a plane that is in its stage of development. Well, the GAO reports and the tests that happened at the end of March of this year showed that the B-2 could only perform its mission 26% of the time. Three-quarters of the time, this incredibly expensive stealth bomber, $2 billion a pop, could not perform its mission mainly because of the problems with the skin, the stealthy skin that needed constant repair. So Northrop Grumman is definitely trying to spin their way out of this problem. The other thing they're trying to do is to buy their way out of this problem by donating money to Congress. One of the things that I'm sure your listeners would be outraged to know is that Northrop Grumman contributed almost $1 million in campaign contributions during the last election cycle, and they gave approximately $2,500 a piece to Congress people who voted for the B-2 bomber, which is more than six times the amount that they gave to Congress people who voted against the B-2 bomber. So they're clearly targeting their campaign contributions and trying to get Congress people to keep approving these planes, which, in fact, someone should really go to jail for this, because this is just a scandal that $45 billion of American taxpayer money has been spent on a Cold War relic, which doesn't work, which doesn't even have a purpose. I mean, it was designed for the Cold War. If I can just one final comment on this, when it was made operational finally this last spring, there was a joke going around on TV. I think it was Bill Maher of Politically Incorrect, who was saying, you know, great, $2 billion apiece, and they finally finished this Cold War turkey. Why don't they spend another $3 or $4 billion and add a time machine so we can send it back to the Cold War where we might have actually needed it? It's just remarkable that this thing, in spite of the end of the Cold War, in spite of all the difficulties that it has, the fact that it really doesn't work, continues to go on. And the fight right now is to get Congress in conference committee to finally kill this. The House of Representatives voted $331 million this summer to continue producing 9 more B-2 bombers, which, by the way, the Air Force doesn't want, the White House doesn't want, but the House of Representatives has voted $300 million to start building 9 more of them. So what I really encourage people to do is call their Congress people this week and let them know that however they can leverage pressure in that conference committee to stop the B-2 bomber, it is time to end this turkey.
That's the stealth. What about the F-22 fighter planes? We read earlier in the week in some of the newspapers that they had just done a test drive of one of them. I think this is Lockheed Martin's, mm-hmm. and that they're planning to spend $43 billion on some more.
Well, in terms of the price estimate, for starters, I want to say if you believe price estimates that come out of the military industry, quite frankly, you either have to be a fool or a member of Congress, because no price estimate that the military industry has come for their expensive hardware has ever even come close to accurate.
Is there any chance of being both?
Yes, in fact, that was the end of the punchline. Just to give you an example, the B-2 bomber, which we were just talking about, when it was originally, they started talking about it in 1981, the Air Force at that time said that they could build 132 of the B-2 bombers for $22 billion. Well, in fact, we've already spent $45 billion, and we haven't even yet finished building 20 of the planes, which with my math is roughly a 1,200% increase in price. So to think that any estimate that Lockheed Martin gives for the F-22 is anywhere close to accurate is ridiculous. I think the much larger point, however, is once again, why are we building thousands of new fighter planes at the cost of hundreds of billions of dollars when we're in a post-Cold War era where the only real threat to the United States is the advanced air fighter airplanes that we are selling to foreign countries? And one story that I've told often when I'm speaking is the fact that Lockheed Martin, which is the prime contractor for the F-22, when they went to Congress to sell it, they actually had brochures which identified all the F-16s that we've sold abroad, U.S. F-16s, as threats to American security and a reason to spend tens or hundreds of billions of dollars on the F-22. So this is really quite the scam that's going on here, and their price estimates really have no meaning right now in terms of how much money we're going to lay out for weapons we simply don't need.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Gordon Clark, for joining us. Executive Director of Peace Action, the nation's largest grassroots peace and disarmament organization. And by the way, the website, if you want to find out more information on landmines, is www.vvaf.org. That's www.vvaf.org.
Can I give a phone number?
Your phone number?
If people want to call Peace Action to get involved in our work on the B-2, the stealth landmines, you can reach us at 800-228-1228. That's 1-800-228-1228. 1228.
Thanks for being with us, Gordon.
Always a pleasure, Amy.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. 20 years ago today, Steve Biko, the young leader of South Africa's Black Consciousness Movement, died in a police station in the country's capital of Pretoria. He had been tortured in Port Elizabeth. Widely considered one of the great leaders of the struggle against apartheid, Steve Biko is credited with developing the militant ideological and psychological tools, namely Black Consciousness, which were crucial in the fight against apartheid. 30 years old at the time of his death, Biko was beaten unconscious in a Port Elizabeth police station before being driven naked and in chains about 700 miles to a prison in Pretoria, where he died on September 12, 1977. Today, official memorials for Biko will be held across South Africa, including a major speech by President Nelson Mandela, which he has just given in Steve Biko's honor. Yesterday, Steve Biko's wife, Nancy Kalelo Biko, spoke to reporters about today's memorials, a monument to be unveiled in his honor, a monument, a statue of Steve Biko in East London in South Africa, as well as the renaming of a bridge in his honor, a bridge he was taken over many times by South African police. This is what she had to say.
Yes, very much. So much that I really... I can't explain how I appreciate this whole process of this commemoration. Well, for so long, really, I've been haunted by the fact that I had wished that one day an occasion of this nature could happen. So indeed, I think that dream has come true now.
Later in the show, we'll hear what Ms. Biko has to say about the Truth and Reconciliation Commission hearings that have just taken place in Port Elizabeth, where Stephen Biko's murderers have been talking about, well, what they want the country to know about his murder. But right now, we're going to turn to Donald Woods. Donald Woods was a close friend of Steve Biko, also his biographer. He wrote the book Biko. And he was former editor of the Daily Dispatch in East London, South Africa, which published many of Biko's writings under different names. Donald Woods' reporting is credited with bringing Steve Biko's story to an international audience. We caught up with him just a few hours ago before he left for the commemoration services in East London, where he was also there for the 125th anniversary of his newspaper, The Daily Dispatch. I started by asking him how he first met Steve Biko.
An associate of his came to my office and suggested that I should go meet him. Because he was in a restricted area. He wasn't allowed to travel out of that area. And it was 40 miles away from where I was, and I felt that was a reasonable request, so I went to meet him.
And what was that first meeting like?
It was very tense because I'd been attacking him and his associates for black consciousness, which I thought at the time, mistakenly, was a form of racism in reverse. And so for about 5 or 6 hours, we had quite a dispute about it. But I soon realized that I'd been wrong, and I was very impressed with him, and we ended up being good friends.
What was his main argument to you then about what the black consciousness movement was?
Well, I would need about a couple of hours to go into this fully. But basically, and at risk of making a superficial summary of it, they were trying to inculcate pride in black history and black political leaders and black achievements at a time when they felt that blacks had been psychologically made to feel inferior, you know, over several centuries.
What was it that changed your mind, and what was it that most impressed you about Steve Biko as you came to know him?
The power of his logic and his personality and his intellect.
How did your relationship develop? How did you come to meet him more, have more conversations with him? How did your relationship evolve?
Well, I would usually go to where he was because he was not allowed to travel. Although he sometimes broke the ban and came to visit us at our house without the police knowing, he would elude his monitors. And so in various ways, we met quite often.
How did you express your changing views in the Daily Dispatch, and how were they received?
Well, I wrote editorials and I wrote articles which set that out. And also we published Steve Biko's articles, which were not identified as such because he was not allowed to be published or to be quoted. So we just used other names and published his articles.
What was the reaction to them?
Pretty good, actually. You know, most of our readers are black, and they responded very positively.
Can you tell me about the Daily Dispatch? I understand that you're celebrating the 125th anniversary of the newspaper.
That's right. It has long been quite an extraordinary newspaper, and I had the honor of being the guest speaker last night at its 125th birthday banquet, in which I pointed out that the Dispatch is unique. I don't have another newspaper in the world which routinely gave two-thirds of its profits to charity, which was had its whole board of directors as newspaper people, and its shareholders were workers on the paper plus their families, and that made it unique. In fact, we were the first to have black journalists paid the same as white journalists and given executive positions.
What kind of pressure did you come under during your years as editor, and what kind of pressures did the paper come under?
Well, everything from bullets being fired into the building to bomb threats to prosecutions by the government, legal actions. We had 37 legal actions altogether. I was sentenced to 6 months in prison, which I never served. I kept staying out on the technicality. And then ultimately I was banned That is to say, arrested without a warrant or without legal process, and forbidden to write anything for a total of 12 years, ultimately. Not allowed to leave the magisterial area in which I lived, or to speak with more than one person at a time, and a whole range of restrictions like that.
We're talking to Donald Woods, who is the editor of the Daily Dispatch in South Africa, became a close friend of Steve Biko. We've been following closely the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and right now it's in Port Elizabeth in the midst of the testimony of the murderers of Steve Biko. Can you tell us a little about them and what you knew about them in 1977, what you understood when Steve Biko was tortured and killed?
Well, I wrote a book about Steve Biko in which I named these people as his killers, and we knew that they were among those who killed him. What we didn't know then, and we still don't know now, is exactly how they did it. I never at any stage thought that his murder was intentional, his killing was intentional. I don't think that anyone in the government or in the security police wanted him killed. In fact, they knew that his death meant big trouble for them. And what I think really happened was, and I blame the government of the time for that as well, was that you had unlimited power given to security police thugs over detainees, as they call them, prisoners, who were arrested without trial. Unlimited power to beat them up, to torture them. And many of our political prisoners died under such so-called interrogation. And so I don't think that the fact that they didn't intend to kill him mitigated in any way the fact that this was a murder, because under South African law, going back many years, you are presumed to intend the reasonable consequences of your actions. And if you beat up someone that severely, you may be presumed to intend that they should die. So at that time, we branded them publicly as the killers. And now they've come forward to admit it and to try and get amnesty for their actions.
And what do you think about that?
I don't think they should get it, because they have not fulfilled the main condition for such amnesty. And if they don't fulfill it, they should not get amnesty. And that is to make a full disclosure of what happened. The evidence they've been giving in the last couple of days is just a repeat of the old story we heard 20 years ago, the ludicrous claim that five grown adult men had to defend themselves so vigorously against one prisoner that he ended up with brain damage and dying as a result.
How did Steve Biko's consciousness evolve?
Well, that would require several hours of discussion. But it did have links with black American history and personalities such as Marcus Garvey and Toussaint Louverture and people like that in the Caribbean. And, of course, African figures, Africanist approach to history, and the research of the real history of Africa, which is often overlooked in the West.
How was he exposed to people like Toussaint Louverture of Haiti, Marcus Garvey of the United States?
Well, he read what they said and wrote, and he read about analyses of them. He had a brilliant mind, and he was a student at Natal University. And so that's where he first became exposed to these ideas.
What did Steve Biko think of Martin Luther King and Malcolm X?
Well, he was a great admirer of them both, although I would say he would have been ideologically closer to Malcolm X, in that Steve Biko was or advocated nonviolence, but not as a principle. You know, he wasn't against violence on principle as Dr. King was or Mahatma Gandhi. He was against violence as a tactic at that time in South African history, and was quite openly ready to espouse violence if the other did not work.
We're talking to Donald Woods again, white South African journalist who befriended Steve Biko, wrote extensively about him and wrote a biography of him after he died. If Steve Biko were alive today, where do you think his politics would be, and how would they compare to Nelson Mandela?
I think they'd be very similar. Of course, everyone who knew Steve Biko, you know, might have different views, but my own feeling is that he would be right in the forefront of the government of national reconciliation with Mandela, because at the time of his death, he was working for the unity between the African National Congress and the Pan-Africans Congress and the Black Consciousness Movement. So he was a unifier and a reconciler, and I think he would have favored the present setup, which is based on the government of national reconciliation.
For those who aren't familiar with the politics of South Africa, what do each of those movements represent?
Well, the African National Congress is the broad church of black resistance, Nelson Mandela's party, and that for many years, nearly 100 years now, has been inclusive of all races, has campaigned for an utterly non-racial democracy and gender equality. And the others, the Pan-Africanist Congress, has been more Africanist in that, like the Black Consciousness Movement, it has said that whites should not be in the leadership structures that blacks should lead, because their blackness has long been the symbol of their oppression, and they had to make that the symbol of their resistance and their liberation, and that whites had no part in that except in a very subservient position or subsidiary position.
Today is the 20th anniversary of the murder of Steve Biko by South African police officers. As President Mandela dedicates a statue of him in East London, what are your thoughts today?
That's right. In fact, that's what my thoughts are on, because in only a couple of hours, President Mandela will be unveiling a bronze statue, 8 foot high, big statue of Steve Biko, right in front of the City Hall here, in the city, because this is the place where he was so often imprisoned, interrogated. He used to be driven past our house and taunted by the security police, who'd say, "Don't you wish you were in there having a drink with your friends?" They used to drive him across the biggest bridge in the city to Fort Glamorgan Prison. And the bridge today is also being renamed by President Mandela as the Biko Bridge, which is a terrific irony, because for 25 years it has been known as the Forster Bridge after the apartheid Prime Minister B.J. Forster, and now today it's going to be renamed the Biko Bridge. So we'll have the statue unveiled and the bridge renamed by Mandela this morning.
Where did Steve Biko get his strength? Where did he come from?
Well, geographically, from a small town about 40 miles from here called King Williamstown. And where he got his intellect from, I think the same place as Mozart got his musical ability from. We don't know. These people are like one-offs, you know. They have extraordinary gifts, and they seem to have them from an early age.
How did your meeting with him more than 20 years ago change your life?
Well, very radically, in that I'm a fairly orthodox liberal white, and I began to see the power in many of his arguments, not all of them. I mean, to this day, I still disagree with some elements of the Black Consciousness philosophy, but I thought that most of what he said made sense and would benefit the country. And as a result of that, I was myself imprisoned and banned and subject to those restrictions that he had had. And in that way, it changed our lives. And eventually, my family and I escaped from South Africa, as portrayed by Kevin Kline in Cry Freedom. And as Cry Freedom told the story, that's how it happened.
If people want to learn most about Steve Biko, what do you recommend they read?
Well, there are about five books about him, including my own, which is simply called Biko. There's a book of his early writings called I Write What I Like, and that's edited by his friend Father Aylward Stubbs. And there are other books about him. And I just think that to read about him and find out how he thought and how he felt about things and how he acted when provoked. And there's an extraordinary chapter in which he writes about if his own death should happen, in which he predicts, actually, that if he is killed, it will be a very politicizing death, which will advance his cause almost as powerfully as if he was alive.
And that certainly is what happened.
It is. You know, his death, I think, greatly accelerated the downfall of apartheid. It fast-forwarded the whole process. It accelerated the pace of economic sanctions from abroad, and thus it cut off the oxygen of investment and loans, which had kept apartheid going for so long.
Well, I want to thank you very much. That was Donald Woods, who was the author of Biko's biography by the same name, Biko. He was the dear friend of Stephen Biko, had published his writings in the Daily Dispatch in East London in South Africa under different names. And he is in right now in, oh, I think it was East London where he was, and he was there for the celebrations of Steve Biko's life, as well as the 125th anniversary of his own newspaper, the Daily Dispatch. I spoke with him just a few hours ago before he went off to the commemoration ceremonies. When we come back, we're going to speak with the Biko family attorney, and then you're going to hear from Nelson Mandela, who just gave a speech a few minutes ago. We'll be playing what he had to say about Stephen Biko and about his own future. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
Come on!
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I am Amy Goodman. This past week in Port Elizabeth, South Africa, the Truth and Justice Commission, officially known as the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, heard from the murderers of Stephen Biko. They are seeking amnesty. Stephen Biko's family is opposed to them getting amnesty. But the question is how much truth they have told. Again, Mrs. Nancy Kilelo Biko, the wife of Steve Biko, speaking yesterday after the hearings ended, at least for this week, for the murderers of her husband.
But I've just arrived now from Port Elizabeth, where I was listening to Sneyman speaking there. It's not the first time that I've listened to him. I was there at the inquest, and I listened to the lies. I really wouldn't like to preempt what's going to happen, but from what I heard, I don't think there's nothing much that's going to be new or different from what I heard in 1977. I expect everybody who gets there to have full disclosure of the circumstances. So I'm really not sure if that's happening, but as I say, I really wouldn't like to comment much about this because it's only the first day of the hearings. We still have to listen to more people.
Nancy Kilelo Biko, the wife of Steve Biko, speaking yesterday in Port Elizabeth. We now turn to George Bizos, who is a leading human rights lawyer in South Africa and the Biko family attorney representing them before South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission. We speak to him in Port Elizabeth, where Biko was imprisoned and tortured before being moved to Pretoria, where he died 6 days later, on this day, 20 years ago. I asked him to talk about the testimony that has been heard so far before the Truth Commission.
I
retired security policeman who was then a captain, Harold Snyman, who was in charge of the interrogation of Steve Biko on the 6th of September 1977, was the first applicant for amnesty. He gave evidence that to the effect that what he said to the inquest or inquiry in November 1977 was false, and that he did that on the instructions of his superior officer in order to avoid adverse publicity for the security police for the good of the country. That was the main thrust of his evidence, and he gave a very detailed description of the orders that he had carried out. But he said very little or gave any detail as to how the injuries that led to Biko's death were inflicted either by him or his four colleagues that were in the interrogation room when he got hurt.
It sounds like he has admitted there was a police cover-up, and maybe that is new, but what he said about what happened, is that anything different from what you knew 20 years ago?
Hardly. They, I believe that he and the others are keeping back. They don't want to tell us what really happened. And that it may be that that is the weakest part of their application, because they have to prove that they committed the criminal act of which they are accused with a political objective to be achieved, but they hardly come to within the terms of the legislation by very gingerly admitting that they did anything of any importance which was wrong.
Now, when you say legislation, you mean the legislation that grants amnesty to people who apply to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission?
Yes, that is so. They have to you see, only a person who has committed a crime can be considered to be given amnesty. What they are saying is hardly a crime. They come to very close to saying that it was just one an unfortunate accident which occurred whilst they were trying to subdue Biko, which is not acceptable. The injury that led to the contra coup brain damage was an injury which required tremendous force, and in all probability was inflicted by a punch on the above the eye that led to the brain being smashed on the other side of the skull that led to his death.
Now, I'm looking at what Dantje Siebert had to say, one of the officers. In his written application, he says that it was Biko who attacked them and who hit his own head against the wall.
Well, Siebert has started giving evidence today, but he did not finish, and the case had to be postponed because there is no more time available on the committee's calendar, and it was postponed to the beginning of December. But he has said that, except that Snyman, who gave evidence before him, under pressure admitted that Biko was punched. He was very coy about who it was that punched him and how many times and where and what happened immediately after the punching. But under those circumstances, Siebert was constrained to say that there were punches both from Biko and himself. And also Snyman admitted that one of their number, Nivot, actually produced a piece of hosepipe. Is that an expression known to Americans? A rubber hose, yes. He hit Biko with that in order to restrain him. What we put to Snyman, which created quite a response from the hundreds of people watching the proceedings, why was it necessary to either punch him or hit him with a hosepipe if there were five policemen there and each one of them could hold a hand and a foot and have a policeman to spare in order to subdue him? If you punched him or assaulted him with a hosepipe, you were likely to anger him and make it even more difficult to subdue him. He hardly had an answer to that proposition. What is new is that they tentatively agree that it wasn't only a scuffle, but that there was an assault. But they don't go as far as to say that there was the sort of assault that would have led to the injury that caused his death.
What about Gideon Nivot, who hasn't testified yet, another former South African police officer involved with the 1977 killing of Steve Biko? My understanding is he was one of the most notorious sadists in South Africa.
Well, he is applying for amnesty not only for Biko's death, but the death of what is called the PEPCO 3. These are the three leaders of the African people in Port Elizabeth in the 80s. He was also responsible, according to his own application for amnesty, for the death of Goniwe and Kalata and their two companions.
And they were?
They were from Craddock, a semi-rural town nearby. But Goniwe was a real hero. He was a mathematics teacher who was very, very popular and one of the regional leaders of the United Democratic Front in 1985. He also has been convicted and has a 20-year sentence, but which has been stayed pending his application for amnesty for killing two of his colleagues and two others, the security policemen, in order to cover up other activities where he feared that his colleagues would expose his criminal activities.
And so here these men are before the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. If they tell the truth, according to the law, they may well get amnesty as they describe these heinous crimes they have committed. What is your feeling about that, and what is the Biko family's feeling about that?
Yes, well, it's not as simple as that. Not only do they have to tell the truth, but that there was a political objective to be achieved, and also that the act was not disproportionate to what they were really reacting to. And they may fail on those grounds. And as far as Nivot is concerned, the killings were in order to cover up fraudulent acts in order to gain personally, and that they can't get amnesty for. But in answer to your question, how does one feel when heinous crimes are being described and amnesty may be granted? It is one of the matters with which we have to live, because there was no option. If there was no process in terms of which amnesty could be granted, there would not have been a settlement at the end of 1993, and we would probably have continued, probably led to civil war, and the political settlement that we did have would just not have been entered into. So that individuals such as members of the the Biko family, the widows of the Pepco 3 or the Cradock 4, are obviously very sore about the possibility of amnesty being granted. It's unlikely that they will get amnesty for everything, because in relation to the Cradock 4, two of the people just happened to be in the car. And once they wanted to eliminate Goniwa and Kalata, the political activists, they had to execute the two companions, because they would have been witnesses to the kidnapping and murder. So that they probably will not get away with it all. But had it not been for the amnesty process, these widows would never have known who killed their husbands, their sons, and daughters of the victims would not have known who had killed their fathers. On the wider level, there would not have been a settlement. And this is one of the compromises that often have to be entered into in order to put an end to the blood feud.
And how does Mrs. Biko feel about that?
She feels very upset, and she expresses the view that at the very least that she expected was a full disclosure, so that she came to know, and that her son and other members of her family came to know precisely what happened. But she is very upset that what has emerged is a renewed mismatch of their admitted lies in the previous inquiry in 1977.
We're talking to George Bizos, who is the Biko family lawyer. In Port Elizabeth, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission hearings have just concluded for a while, and it's the murderers of Steve Biko who are applying for amnesty that are testifying in these hearings. How does a country deal with respect for law and order if the way they deal with what happened through apartheid is for people to tell the truth and them then to be given amnesty? Because you have someone now who goes out on the street and pickpockets, they will be given more jail time than some of these murderers.
Well, what you have to weigh that against is that if this arrangement in relation to amnesty was not entered into at the end of 1993, there would have been no settlement, there would have been a civil war in which very many more people would probably have died. That's what you have to weigh it against, and not the example of the pickpocket.
George Bizos speaking to us from Port Elizabeth, South Africa. He is the Biko family attorney, has been for the last 20 years, and is representing them before South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission. The murderers of Steve Biko are in the midst of speaking about what they have done, although it has now been put off until December, the rest of those hearings. We now turn to President Nelson Mandela of South Africa, who is in East London, South Africa, giving a speech about Steve Biko and also announcing his retirement. It happened just a little while ago.
We are confident that by forging a new and prosperous nation, we are continuing the fight in which Steve Biko paid the supreme sacrifice. We hope that by unveiling this statue, renaming the bridge, and declaring his Ginzburg House a national monument, we are making our own humble contribution to immobilizing his life. I will be retiring as President of the African National Congress at the end of this year. I will be retiring as president of this country at the end of my term, which will be the beginning of 1999. Men who do not know when the time has come for them to step down are playing with fire. I don't want to play with fire. My time to go has come, and I am going to go.
South African President Nelson Mandela announcing his retirement at the beginning of 1999 as President of South Africa and honoring Steve Biko on this 20th anniversary of his murder. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin. Andy York is our Washington engineer. Thanks also to Kevin Cartwright. Julie Drizin, our executive producer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!